The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Thank you very much, Professor Harris, for that introduction and setting the tone for us. Thank you also, Professor Eisenstadt, for your introduction. I think we have at least gotten an idea of the complexity of the issue that we're discussing today. So now we'd like to move into a more specific topic, actually one of the trade-offs that Professor Eisenstadt mentioned, and that's whether customary law, or whether there's this juxtaposition of group rights versus individual rights when you're dealing with customary law issues. And so I'd like to just introduce you briefly to our panel. First, we have as a moderator Professor Mitali Jain. She is a practitioner in residence in the International Human Rights Law Clinic here at WCL. She also teaches a seminar on comparative social and economic rights. Professor Jain previously served as a judicial clerk for the Constitutional Court of South Africa in 2005, and she's worked with a number of community-based organizations. So she's going to be able to provide us with an interesting perspective from her work. Also with us today is Professor Rachel Rebuchet. She is an Associate Director of Adolescent Health Programs at the National Partnership for Women and Families. And at WCL here, she teaches family law and comparative family law as an adjunct professor. Professor Rebuchet has worked as a law clerk as well in South Africa on the Constitutional Court, so we may have a lot of interesting perspectives from South Africa on this panel. And she has published on comparative abortion law, the Protocol to the African Charter on the Rights of Women, Gender and Post-Conflict Power Sharing Agreements, and the Strategies for Lawyers Collectives in Human Rights Reform. Professor Ezra Rosser is currently teaching housing law, federal Indian law, property, and poverty law at WCL. He has served as a fellow at various law schools throughout the country, and he was recently selected as the AALS Poverty Section's chair-elect. He's also a member of the Equal Justice Works National Advisory Committee. So we welcome you, and we look forward to the discussion.
Thank you. Thank you, Eleanor, and thanks to Hadar for kind of setting the tone for what I think will be an interesting panel in posing that second question that she did of what are the inherent or actual tensions between customary law, looking at collective rights versus individual rights. And so we're going to take some time to look at that and focus on that particular question, start to contextualize it within a few different jurisdictions and looking at different populations. As we've talked about with customary law, it's really operative within a communal unit, where you're looking at the community as the holder of certain rights. And as many of us know, the evolution of international human rights law has been largely a post-World War II development that has focused primarily on the individual. And so the traditional critique, I think, of customary law is that, in fact, there is this inherent tension between group rights and individual rights. And so I just want to pose a few questions, kind of frame a few questions for our speakers, and then I'd like to turn it over to Professors Rebuchet and Rosser to take a look at these questions from different perspectives. I believe Professor Rebuchet will look at the participation in and impact of customary law on women, and Professor Rosser looking at it from the perspective of Indian tribes, primarily the Navajo Nation. And so some of the questions that I'm particularly interested in is this tension that's often talked about, is it true? Are these tensions inherent to the ways in which customary law plays out? And if so, what are the different contexts in which we see these tensions playing out? Also want to take a look more kind of optimistically at, if these tensions do exist, what are some approaches or methods of trying to resolve these tensions in a productive way? And finally, I'd be curious to hear also thinking about the forum in which these rights are adjudicated. What is the proper forum within which to adjudicate these rights? We see different entities around the world at this point seeking to adjudicate these rights, from regional human rights bodies to the UN to domestic courts. And I'd be curious to hear if there's, based on your own analysis and research, whether you have specific ideas about kind of who's best situated to be looking at these rights. So why don't I turn it over first to Professor Rebouché, and we can hear from her.
So I want to thank also the organizers for inviting me to speak on this panel. As they have instructed me, I'm going to offer some brief and broad comments that generally deal with the feminist use and feminist intervention in international law, to use international law as a way to address perceived failures of customary law. And I will suggest that this dominant model of feminist advocacy, I'm going to use two examples, drafting the protocol to the African Charter on the Rights of Women, and then a national example, strategy that I've mapped in South Africa, Ethiopia, Nepal, and other countries, of repeal of abortion laws, to suggest that the relationship's a little complicated, and that actually feminists have been fairly successful in their advocacy strategies, but their failure to account for customary law in a more perhaps dynamic fashion has really limited some of those wins. So first, I wanted to say thank you, because I'm particularly delighted to speak on this panel teaching the comparative family law course here. I just wanted to offer a brief comment that, you know, it's exciting for me because family law itself has, as you well know, not traditionally been the province of comparative or international law, particularly because it's been seen as organic, unique, too embedded with custom. And to this point, I found very helpful Duncan Kennedy's work on globalization and showing how distinct and deeply, how deep this distinction runs between private and public law, looking at Savigny and others who, through the history of comparative law analysis, have really exceptionalized family law because of its relationship with customary practices, and has further done, I think, a fantastic job showing how that distinction has been part of colonial projects to open markets and internationalize law so that private law in colonized countries will be receptive to opening trade, and marginalizing family law, making that the province of custom in ways that potentially fossilize customary law and family law, in service of opening trade and of colonial projects. And I only raise that to suggest that informs my work in thinking about distributive consequences of feminist projects, because that split between private and public really was truly only exploded with the international human rights movement, I think, and I think many others. Thank God I don't claim to have come up with that. Because if you look at, you know, some of the great comparative work, family law is still exceptionalized, customary law is still exceptionalized, and international human rights law really did put it on the agenda for many who were interested in a comparative critical project. And you see it written all over the international human rights documents, rights to foreign family, rights to family privacy, and not to oversimplify, these very kind of liberal projects around family protection. I think what's the tension we're talking about in some ways is then this erupting dichotomy that's now been pervasive and tenacious in our modern thinking about rights between this individualist conception of equality and custom and culture, the rights of culture and of an indigenous people, and the rights of individuals to non-discrimination and to individual autonomy. And I think that's why repeatedly gender equality is described as the Achilles heel, the example that best encapsulates this tension. And like our moderator, I'm going to push back that dichotomy is as deep or as divisive as it need be. So, particularly because where you see this most is in the regulation of marriage. I mean, that's really been the forum where scholarship has focused primarily on distributive consequences, the role of regulation, constitutional or legislative, in either ignoring customary marriages or preferring civil or state-based marriages, and in the power relationships between spouses, men and women, and considering how law and regulation has either embedded or exacerbated the power differential. So that said, I'm going to use that dichotomy that it has already found its way in our conversations from this morning, the excellent presentation we heard, and in Hadar's comments, to push back that feminists have been the losers in the conversation about custom. And I'd like to offer just two very brief examples because I don't want to take time away from Ezra. Will you let me know when I'm
sure?
Okay. So the first is actually the process of drafting the protocol to the African Charter on the Rights of Women. As many of you in this room will know, the charter itself is a little bit different than other regional or international human rights instruments, and it's very explicit and clear valuation of community values and of custom. Article 17 of the charter provides a state duty to promote morals and traditional values, and Article 29 elaborates on the special role of the state and the individual in protecting cultural norms and morals. And both those provisions have in the past been cited by national courts in the African region to undermine claims brought to court on behalf of women, citing gender equality concerns in reference to customary law provisions. With that, the Charter is notoriously quiet on women's rights. There are two references to women, one in a non-discrimination statement that lists sex, and then the second in Article 18, which really speaks in terms of the rights of women and of children under international law. So when the idea took off to write a protocol on the rights of women to the African Charter, mapping that history reveals an interesting conversation about women's rights advocates regionally, locally, as well as internationally, who sought to create an African CEDAW, who sought to write a document that was going to take the respect given to culture and custom in the African Charter, but infuse in it concerns for gender equality that would look more like CEDAW and its progeny, the more modern, the women's rights documents and declarations of the last 20 years. And as I think my research suggests, they may not have succeeded in the ways that they may have wanted. First, because the commitment to writing an African CEDAW didn't include a commitment or mechanisms to try to balance tensions between custom and equality, to try to resolve some of the fights that would inevitably erupt around polygamy, registered marriages, other issues among these discussions of signatories to the protocol in ways that would actually use the context of these customary provisions, of that tension, in a way to negotiate some middle ground. The result, I argue, is if you read the text of the protocol, a much more CEDAW-oriented document that reveals a scattering of different feminist influences, dominance feminism, liberal feminism, but doesn't necessarily capture in ways that I would like to hear your thoughts on some of the goals of its drafters, that of creating something that harmonized, that created a middle ground for custom and gender equality. And not to overstate the point, clearly the protocol does speak to that with Article 17's right to a positive cultural context. But in my work, and my focus in particular on health and reproductive rights in the Article 14 provisions, there's a glaring lack of language or a thought behind what provisions might actually be relevant to a large population of African women. For example, framing reproductive rights in those terms of choice and equality, in this model of liberal feminism, when, you know, there was a lot of thought behind the communal values that dictate reproductive choices and family decisions and how those are often in conflict with this liberal model. That and also understating the role of socioeconomic rights in promoting health and reproductive rights. Absent from this provision on health is a highest attainable standard language, which would have been in keeping with the standard that many African countries have already signed on to through the Economic, Cultural, Social Rights Covenant. So how am I doing for time? 5 minutes. Okay. And so very quickly, the second example where I think I want to open to discussion some of the problematic ways in which this dichotomy between gender and custom has been framed is actually in the national repeal of abortion laws. Just for the purposes of time, I'm going to talk for a couple of minutes about South Africa, which in 1996 passed the Choice on Termination of Pregnancy Act, which has widely been heralded as one of the most progressive forward-thinking abortion laws in the world. In the same way, I might suggest to you that this women's rights win actually is limited in the sense of its failure to take into account the context in which that act has to be implemented. And I think as shown by the limited success in implementing the act, maternal morbidity is unfortunately as high as it was when abortion was illegal. Or very limited in South Africa, marked by widespread refusals by physicians and other medical professionals to deliver services, and as troubled by a very failing infrastructure for healthcare. One of the things that I have thought a lot about in that context is the role that custom and history played interconnected to this issue. So in particular in South Africa, there was this troubled relationship within the progressive community around abortion liberalization because of the very racist family planning policies under apartheid, which caused severe divisions between advocates, anti-apartheid advocates. Moreover, the topic of our conversation today, abortion in many communities was outside the scope of the state. You had British and Dutch laws that criminalized abortion, but in practice you had communities that more informally and more through family decisions or through tribal councils or through other community mechanisms allowed abortion for particular reasons. There was a young woman who was not married. Someone who felt that she was not able to become a mother, a more context-driven process of decision-making. I think that feminist reliance on, and this is the aspect that I've had to leave out because of time, feminist reliance on international human rights has formalized an approach that relies on rights to at times the detriment of those contextual factors. And it's not to suggest that feminists have all the resources in the world, and you know, it is interesting to note that there are some predictable paths that this advocacy takes and that it has some predictable implementation problems as a result. So I am over time, but I offer these two examples and to elicit your comments. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And we'll hold off on questions until we've heard also from Professor Rosser, and then we'll open the floor.
One second. Great. The reason there was some difficulty getting this loaded is I didn't finish it until 10 this morning, so it's not the organizer's fault at all. It's entirely me. I have a newborn that's now going to be 3 months in tomorrow, turns 3 months old, and I've discovered that the biggest mistake as far as productivity you can do is have a child. I apologize for that, and I apologize to my class every time I have class. Okay, so today I'm going to be talking a little bit about different conceptions of the good and how this relates to potential tensions between collective and individual rights. And I'm going to be focused on the Navajo Nation. What's great, I'm really excited about this conference, largely because it got Christine Zuni Cruz to come here. So I think if I was to pick people who should be talking instead of me, it's Christine, and she'll be talking later. So I think that that is well done by the organizers. Hadar started off by talking about the condescending aspects of the way that we think about customary law, and I think part of this, the Navajo courts have rejected some of the definitions that we've already heard, and they've done that by analogizing between customary law and common law, or equating customary law and common law. The other things I think that are interesting from what we've already heard, Rachel talked about the importance of family law, and largely my talk is based entirely a ripoff, or at least my reading of Ray Austin's, a new book that just came out in 2009. He was a former Chief Justice of the Navajo Nation Supreme Court, and he just came out with a new book on what Navajo courts and Navajo common law is. And because of this conference, I had to read the book, which I finished around 11:30 last night. There we go. The topics I think I want to talk about are locating and defining tribal customary law, and do tell me when to stop. I'm going to keep talking until I'm told to stop. The nature of collective rights and the question of what qualifies as a collective right, and this can be along different levels, family, clan, or tribe. The internal balance of collective and individual rights, and I think when it's internal balance, that clarifies that the tension is largely with the external. Tension with individual rights is defined by Biliganas. So Navajos, the word for non-Indians, Anglos, is Biligana. And Biligana, there's another spelling you can use. The downside about having somebody you respect in the audience who knows more than you is that there's somebody in the audience who knows more than you. So you may hear more qualifiers. But Biliganas, according to my dad's wife, means white, other, or the enemy. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. Tribal court judges and the space between paradigms. So tribal court judges have used customary law, or as the Navajo courts call it, common law, to find a space in between individual and collective rights problems when there's a conflict between how Navajos see things and how non-Indians see things, and maintaining the space for difference in rights-based approaches. So locating tribal customary law, it's important on the East Coast to talk about where tribes are. Here's a map of some tribes. Obviously, this doesn't include Alaska or Hawaii. The tribe that I'm talking about the most is the Navajo Nation. It's in the Four Corners area. Ann Parsons, who I don't believe is in the room, is actually organizing an alternative spring break trip to the Navajo Nation with 10 students. So we'll be hearing more about Navajo stuff here in WCO. Okay. It's the size of West Virginia, and it's what I'm most familiar with. I grew up somewhere around there and there. So the Navajo Nation Supreme Court has a preference for the term common law over customary law, and they do this because they want it to be better understood that the customs and traditions of the Navajo people are law, and the English term, it says, is used because it is more accurately reflects our customs as law. And they one of the things that's interesting is in some of their cases, they'll cite two definitions of what the common law is using Blackstone or other sort of comfortable sources for non-Indians to say we're not much different and what we're doing is the same as was done in England and is done in the United States. And they do this when they're talking about whether to take judicial notice of things or other moments. Ray Austin, the book, what he defines, though, customary law, and this, I think, is different for many non-Indian readers, which is if you were to write about a book about what the laws of the Navajo Nation is, how would you structure it? I think a book from a U.S. Educated non-Indian lawyer would be, there'd be a section on property, there'd be a section, you know, following your first year courses or something like that. The way that the justice did is he gives an overview of the Navajo Nation courts. Largely the overview says these are developed courts, they're handling a lot of cases every year. And there are two types, and I think this non-Indians find interesting. There's the regular courts, which are an offshoot, regular meaning coming from a non-Indian tradition and now made into part of the Navajo court system. And then there's the peacemaker courts. Peacemaker courts, I had actually thought until starting this that they handled a larger caseload, but they don't. And one thing that his memo to the Navajo Nation said most recently was he wishes more people would take advantage of peacemaker processes. But then it moves quickly to the Diné fundamental laws, what these are, and then it breaks it into three different categories, harmony, kinship, and clanship, that define what Navajo common law is. And I don't think you would do that necessarily if you were writing a book about U.S. law, but for the justice or the judge, it was very important that these concepts were found throughout Navajo law. And I think the other reaction, at least initially, when you read this as a non-Indian, as I am, is even though I read a book on it, I'm still not quite sure what he means. And I think there's a real limit to the degree to which a non-Indian who's not, doesn't have the creation stories built into him, can understand how those creation stories relate to harmony, how they relate to kinship, or how they relate to clans. Anybody that's been on the Navajo Nation for a while has some understanding of the clan system, but there's limitations on that. Okay. And this is a very timely conference because recently there was a change made to Diné fundamental law and how that related to the Navajo courts. So from 82 to 2002, the Navajo Supreme Court in particular starts using more and more common law. I'm going to use that term. I'm going to use the term they use, but you can translate it if you want, notes to customary law. But Navajo common law in their opinions. And it goes about setting forth how do you prove common law, what are the contents of common law. But then in 2002, their practice is largely celebrated or made into statutory law by the Navajo Tribal Council, which accepts it and declares Navajo fundamental or Diné, that's their term for themselves. There should be an accent on the E, but I couldn't figure out how to do that in PowerPoint. Fundamental laws as immutable and the highest law. But recently, this last month, the Navajo Tribal Council restricted the use of tribal fundamental laws, of Diné fundamental laws, to the peacemaking courts, and they were not to be used by the Navajo Supreme Court or the district courts. So this is weird. A seemingly very important thing for the Navajo Supreme Court and something that the justices of the Supreme Court have highlighted as being the most important aspect of law on the reservation. The Tribal Council is now saying no. Now, why are they doing that? They're doing that because the court has played a role in the current controversies involving reducing the size of the Tribal Council. My own take on this, and there are no Navajos in the room, I don't think, is that the Tribal Council is largely to be blamed, and the court's resistance is something worth resisting these efforts of the council. But it does tell us that where common law or customary law is, or the role it plays, is of continued interest on the Navajo Nation. Okay. So the scope of collective rights. One example is Desert Rock. Desert Rock, this is not the actual power plant. This is a different existing power plant. There's a new power plant that's being proposed, and the power plant is going to be coal based on coal. It's going to harm the environment, almost without question. If you were here 2 years ago, President Shirley gave a talk here about desert rock, and his perspective was something like, why do people care about the owls and the animals when they should be caring about the Navajos who are poor? But there are groups of Diné who are not happy with the tribal council and the tribal president's decision to support this power plant. And so the question arises, what rights should those individuals or this group of individuals have to protest the actions of the tribal council? Environmental groups have largely said they have all the rights that a U.S. citizen would have, namely to go before federal courts and try to block it through federal courts or federal processes. I argue in a paper that's coming out fairly soon that that's not the right approach, but that's one example where you can see this. Another is grazing rights. So one of the most important things that you have or that you inherit and that a lot of the cases that you find in the Navajo courts involve are grazing permits and grazing rights. And grazing rights are traditionally passed, it's a matrilineal society, traditionally from the oldest grandmother to the most responsible older woman. But what's interesting about the grazing rights is that the holder is supposed to hold it in a customary trust for all the extended family. But you see, obviously, anytime you have that arrangement where it's a customary trust, but they're the technical holder, technically the holder of those grazing rights, there's going to be a conflict when that trust is violated, right? When the person that holds it starts using it for their own family more than the extended family or other situations. How much time do I have? 5 minutes. Okay. So those are collective rights that I think are very interesting as far as how they play out on the Navajo Nation. The ones that I think are perhaps more interesting to non-Indians are largely the gender ones, but we'll talk about a couple ones. So one is private suits, and that I already mentioned with the Diné Care, which is the environmental group. Another example that legal aid is very involved in on the reservation is Navajo Housing Authority. So the Navajo Housing Authority's done some bad things, and should a resident have the right to sue as they might if they were a resident in public housing. This brings up a lot of questions about tribal sovereign immunity. And then the third category that gets a lot of attention, at least within on the Navajo Nation, is challenges to elections or election results or election processes and the rights of individuals to play a role in stepping in, not just the tribal president or the tribal council. Okay. But the classic examples are Santa Clara Pueblo. So the textbook authors for the leading Indian law textbook, they have a handbook for professors, and it says, a good assignment to your students is to ask them to summarize the case as if they were Joe Sixpack. So I'll do that. This, I think a very good summary of the case is a tribe from a Joe Sixpack perspective, a tribe, the Supreme Court holds that a tribe can discriminate against women. Now that, the Supreme Court's allowance for that does bring up the question, well, what if that Native woman were to bring her claim before an international human rights body? What would be the result of such a claim? And what role should the international human rights bodies play? I think the other examples that are important to think about are banishment or disenrollment. If a tribe disenrolls somebody, should international human rights bodies step in if their individual rights are being violated by the collective? And equal protection. So equal protection, there are three cases that really bring this out. Duro, I think, is covered in some con law classes, but I'm not sure. Maybe Lara as well. Basically, does a tribe have authority over another tribal member, but not a member of that tribe? So another Indian, non-tribal member, right? So does the Navajo Nation have authority over a Ute? And these cases go through it. Duro and Lara are Supreme Court cases. Means is the Navajo Nation Supreme Court's decision on this question. And I have a slide of that. And so what happened in the Means case was he was doing, I think, bad things to his father-in-law and I believe also a brother. He was attacking them. And the Navajo Supreme Court used Hidani status, his status as an in-law, and not U.S. equal protection to base to find that they did have jurisdiction over him. So they used Navajo common law to avoid federal Indian law questions, and the Supreme Court decided not to take cert on this case, even though I think in a case in which it was a more sympathetic challenger, the Supreme Court likely would have. Okay. All these things bring up the importance, and I think this is what, from the perspective of Ray Austin, is the most important, the preservation of the possibility of difference, right, within tribal law. The other aspect that I think is particularly, maybe only interesting to federal Indian law scholars, is the degree to which it's been ignored by scholarship. So it's much more attractive to focus on federal Indian law than tribal law. Partly this may be explained by law review editors seeking out federal questions rather than tribal issues. But it also may be just more attractive because of the particularity that's required when you look at customary law on a tribal basis versus the ability to talk about all tribes when you think about federal Indian law. And so I think 20 to 25 years ago, Nell Newton, who was a professor here and now dean at I think Notre Dame, she wrote an article called Tribal Court Praxis. But there's been very limited development of the scholarship. There's been a lot of development of the court opinions and even access to those opinions, but the scholarship has not kept up with those practices in the tribal courts. I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much.
So I think though Professors Rebuchet and Rosser have approached these questions from different contexts, that they raise a number of similar questions about this actual or apparent tension in between the practice of common or customary law and the protection of individual human rights. And so I encourage you to think of questions that you might be able to have both professors or either professor address. Please come to the mic.
My question would be in regards with international protection of individuals belonging to tribes as a matter of jurisdiction. Would international bodies, like we should ask the question, if international bodies actually have jurisdiction over tribes, if we recognize that these tribes are sovereign and they have their own jurisdictions, the first question would be international tribunals actually have jurisdiction to even see and after that protect individuals alleging international violations to human rights. Thank you.
Okay, I'll start. I think partly it's a question of to what degree. So there's a formal answer, which is if a tribe's sovereignty is not being respected enough by the nation state of which it's located, in which it's located, then maybe they haven't had the opportunity to sign on to these different conventions or international instruments, and so they would not be subject to it formally because of largely the nation-state denial of their sovereignty. But that, I think, only starts to give an answer because some of these tribes or groups are, in fact, going to these international bodies on a non-nation basis, but on a sovereign tribe basis. And the degree to which they go to those nation bodies when it is convenient for them may mean that when it's not convenient, they should be held accountable too. So the example I know best is the Desert Rock. So the tribe has sent, and the tribe paid for it, the tribe paid for the wife of the president, Shirley, to go before international bodies to talk about domestic violence towards women and the failures of the United States to protect women on reservations. But by drawing upon or trying to use those bodies for that purpose, do they then admit some, they're subject to those bodies when it's inconvenient? In this case, does a tribe have the right to pollute more than, say, it should? And I think the way it's been dealt with is there's so much low-hanging fruit for these international human rights bodies that
it's easier, and maybe it's rightly easier, to go after things where a nation state is violating the rights of an indigenous group than to start dealing with the cases where an indigenous group may be violating individual rights of indigenous people. But.
No, I'm a Professor Secondi?
I wanted to thank, can you hear me? I wanted to thank Professor Obrisi for her insights on the African Protocol on the Rights of Women. I haven't studied it as detailed as I should have, and also the law on, in South Africa on abortion. What I think I have as a question, do you conceive, because you posed questions and thought that the protocol does not answer or resolve the conflict between the right to culture and the CEDAW rights for women, would you conceive of any compromise in the tension that exists between the right to culture and the rights women demand, and not only women, but I think various other individual rights that are asserted that fly in the face of what Africans themselves consider as their fundamental ethical beliefs? Because there are quite a number of them right now. Forget easy things, you know, things like female genital mutilation, and forget things like polygamy. But they are very fundamental issues on which Africans believe and hold dear that may be considered to be unacceptable using the individual liberal ethical beliefs. Is there any compromise in this tension that you foresee can be reached, or do you think we really have no way of finding a compromise between the two?
Professor Secondi, perhaps you could offer an example or two to help frame the discussion, the response?
I think a great example of the tension you're highlighting, particularly the practices that would be deeply held by a majority of people in the region, is encapsulated by the debate in the protocol between equal and equitable. And what I mean by that is many states argued against using terms like equal rights in the protocol to the African Charter because it didn't capture the complementarity of men and women's roles. They wanted to reflect the communal value that there's a transactional reciprocity between spouses, that there are certain duties that husbands and wives have that are enforceable by other community obligations that something like equal rights in marriage or divorce or inheritance or other things that would be rights within CEDAW would not capture. Is that a fair example of something that is not potentially as not polygamy, not but and so it, interestingly, I think your question is there an answer? I was attracted to thinking about the protocol because it had such a promising beginning in that regard. What I really have done is just map the drafting process to show that at the beginning was a will to try to figure out some of that compromise, because the motivation for writing the protocol was to create a document that would have ownership, that people would feel an ownership of in various African countries, both men and women. And that being the impetus to write an African CEDAW. What I think the research of that drafting process shows is the points that fell apart. And I think it fell apart because in some of the ways that you're suggesting, a lot of attention was focused on these hot topic issues, polygamy, whether or not to register marriages, abortion, and what was detracted from a drafting process that I think you could see as an example in the Disability Convention, where delegates came together and set out these principles over the course of a set of discussions that were very tense, were very hard fought, but it resulted in principles that guided the discussion going further. And I'm not sure that happened, because I think what you actually see, what actually happens is that the mistake is that women's rights advocates rely so heavily on liberal equality principles in these drafting processes because of their legitimacy, their long-standing history, other things that they cut, that there is an attitude that does not embrace a conversation about those deeply held values and how they might be implemented through a document that purports to promote gender equality. So that's a fairly vague response to what can we do. But I think that there is room to have those conversations in a way that doesn't presume that context will bend to the implementation of a regional instrument that is based on values that the majority of men and women in the region are not going to adhere to. So I don't know if that's responsive.
Other questions? Professor Sibanda.
Thank you. My question is to Professor Rubush. I noted with interest the comments you made with respect to the Choice and Termination of Pregnancy Act in South Africa. And I'd like to hear your thoughts a little bit more about how, or some of your ideas about bridging the distance, about having very nice legislative frameworks which are out of touch with the reality on the ground, because I think a lot of the problems with respect to something like the Choice and Termination of Pregnancy Act is that there is this sense which to me is not something of customary law, but it's part of, I guess, of cultural practice, if you can differentiate the two, where men do have the sense that they own the bodies of even their wives. I mean, it's problematic when it comes to young women, but it's also experienced relative to people who are married. And I've been surprisingly told that even when it comes to issues like breast cancer, men will refuse to let their wives go for mastectomies because of this idea that they own the bodies of their wives. So how do we bridge that gap between great regional frameworks or local legislative frameworks and the rights of women?
So I think that the danger in making the argument that I do in that paper is that it suggests that there are no legs to the gender equality arguments that pervade international human rights, that it is not a worthwhile and important goal to try to foster a sense of agency on the part of women who have to make very private, very important health decisions for themselves. The breast cancer example being a very good one, the decision not to have a child being the obvious point of my paper. So I start with that caveat. I think that in a lot of ways I've found very interesting some of the empirical research that has been done by people like Tracy Higgins, who have spent a lot of time thinking about the distributive consequences of this kind of constitutional rights reform that's driven by just those kind of agency-oriented notions and looking at the backlash to some of those equality principles. So my question is, in thinking about how to bridge the gap, are there more informal governance mechanisms that we could use and promote that would do a better job at filling that gap than legislation or constitutional rights has seemed to do. And so one of the ways you might think about that in the abortion example is a two-pronged strategy. The one I spend a lot of time on in the paper is changing the primary health care system and changing the access to that system. But the one I think that you're suggesting is changing a culture and changing a culture about how women make decisions and how men supervise those decisions. And I think that's certainly trickier in the sense that I think there's lag time. And in some ways, that's why I was so intrigued by this role of customary law in that situation, as is true in Ethiopia and Nepal, because though not marked with hallmarks of agency or rights to equality, there were practices that enabled people to make choices about procreation without the markings of that individualist moment. So, for example, Bangladesh is a great example, that this informal governance model that I might describe is one where it's commonly known that women see traditional healers or a community physician because their menstruation cycle is late. So they go to these healers and say, I need you to start my cycle. Now, it's early term abortion. It's commonly understood that that's what's happening, but it's cabined under this, it's framed as this idea that you're going to help me start my cycle. And it does it avoid some of the cultural change that you might be speaking of? Potentially, I worry about that. But does it accomplish an end and confer agency to a woman and to make procreative decisions? It does. And so I wonder if we could look at these kind of reforms in the long term and as a very complicated set of solutions.
Maybe one last question.
I don't want to monopolize this, but the chair asked me for an example, which I think I would like to give. The point that has been raised with regard to abortion, two things I'd like to make as a contribution. In many of the cases that are hitting the wavelength, the airlines or wave, like for example in Uganda, we are having legislation in parliament with regard to homosexuality. And I think there was also an article out of Malawi on the same thing. And now the question of abortion. Two things. One is that much of this legislation that is being discussed was actually enacted by the British during the colonial times. It's part of the penal code and exists already, criminalizing abortion and criminalizing homosexuality. So current governments are facing these issues now to decide whether these are criminal acts or not criminal acts. Many of the countries in the West have faced the same problem. In England, there was a Royal Commission on the question of homosexuality that eventually decided not to criminalize homosexuality among consenting adults. So there are jurisprudential issues that have to be addressed. The question, I think, in Africa is the following. On the question of abortion, there is a community belief that parents have rights as parents on what a daughter or a son does, even when the son or the daughter is an adult. Similarly, I don't think it's a question of owning. Similarly, a husband has certain rights. It's not ownership. I think this is the pejorative way of looking at it. But husbands do have certain rights in the child in the wife's womb. And the question also arises when you are advocating individual rights. Is it entirely the control of the mother as to what happens to that child? or does a husband or the father of this child have certain rights over it? And how do you balance these rights? And in Africa, they are very strongly held as part of the values of the communities. And if so, then how do you reconcile these two in the face of the feminist demand of the rights of the woman to control her body? That's the issue.
I actually am going to somewhat evade that question. But no, I want to link with an example that I thought of, and I ran out of time in trying to describe, but that relates to Ezra's presentation, because it's interesting you bring that up. In the jurisdictions where there has been repeal of Offenses Against the Person Act, you know, for example, British laws that have a colonial legacy in many countries in Africa, and Charles Nguna, I think, has done a really good genealogy of those laws. But it's interesting that courts have stepped in and tried to mediate the tension you've described by funneling the decisions on who should have some control over an abortion decision to through the common law. So, for example, the case I'm thinking of in South Africa is customary law would have put ownership of a decision around a minor's choice around abortion in primarily family hands. And the act, the new dispensation, puts it in the minors because there's no age limit. A woman of any age can access abortion by design, by a very hard-fought advocacy strategy. That when that question went to the High Court, when it was challenged by Doctors for Life or Christian lawyers or a group, you know, fill in the blank, they challenged that provision of the act saying that a woman under 18 couldn't give informed consent. The court, I think interestingly, mediated that by giving doctors the control to determine maturity. And it actually used a common law standard, the mature minor standard, to decide when a minor should be able to decide whether or not to have an abortion without parental involvement. So not using the standard of the act, which would have had a more absolute standard of agency for the minor, but not giving, you know, rights back to family members who would have then had a veto power over a minor's decision, but using the common law as this interesting mechanism to diffuse the tension between the two. And I was reminded of that in your presentation, this sense that there was this the balancing approach to that. So I don't have an answer for you about how you, in every case, balance the rights of parents and rights of minors or so on and so forth, rights of fathers and rights of mothers. But I do think that it's an interesting tension that is being played out in the implementation of these, of a sea change of this act.
And certainly these questions could give rise to an entire conference on their own. I think, Professor Sikandi, some of your the questions you raise, I think, will be addressed by Professor Sibanda in his keynote address, which will be coming next. So it's a nice segue to lunch and to the keynote address. Why don't we give our panelists a round of applause and then take a short break?
I'd just like to make a quick announcement about lunch, but I'd like to first thank our panelists, Professor Rosser, Professor Robuchet, and Professor Jane, for that discussion. Regarding lunch, there is lunch waiting in the hallway for you. If everyone can grab their lunch, take a break, take 20 minutes, come back and eat, and then we'll start the keynote address. But it's there for you. You can come back in here and eat or eat outside wherever you like, but we'll probably begin again in about 20 minutes. And, of course, you can eat while...